Is It Possible to Know God? The third talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by Wes Hurd on October 9, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
My talk tonight is titled, Is It Possible to Know God? It follows on the schedule after the talk that David Crabtree gave last week, which is titled, Is It Possible to Know? And, again, in the context of this series of talks, this whole series is about the problems that are confronting us today as Christians on the issue of truth in many different realms, in many different ways. The concept of truth is extremely problematic. So that's why we decided to take it on. And if you haven't looked at the roster of talks that are unfolding at this time, you might want to do that. This is the third in the series. Next week, Ron Julian
will be discussing the issue of truth regarding the biblical texts. I don't remember exactly what the title is. Anybody know? But it'll be regarding the reliability of the text, truth, and the biblical texts themselves, the scriptures, and so on. I was actually given this talk, and I was assigned this talk. So I had a lot of homework to do, and I feel like I'm still getting that homework done. I don't pretend to be an expert on this man's religious theory, John Hick. This book is entitled The Fifth Dimension, and this book is entitled God Has Many Names. The assignment, however, was to look at the issue of the problems of truth in relation to, is it possible to know God, and in what sense can we know God, in light of this man's theory, John Hick. What I want to do tonight is to go through this as best I can fairly quickly, because it could be very a dense topic. I want to go through it fairly quickly and then hopefully leave time to by means of questions and answers, fill in things that I'm leaving out, perhaps. Is it possible to know God? In light of the fact that we're asking the question, is it possible to know at all? The question of whether it's possible to know God is even more problematic. It's one thing to question whether you can know whether the onion is sitting on the table or not. It's another thing to ask the question, is God there? And if God is there, who or what is God? Is God knowable? So that's the context for the topic tonight. Now, most of us in the room, in our two rooms here, are coming from a biblical Christian tradition and understanding of life. And so we have a kind of rather mundane, taken for granted attitude that, of course, it's possible to know God. So I'm kind of setting that aside for a little bit tonight and going at the question of, is it possible to know God, sort of outside that framework for a while. I want to just ask it in a different kind of way. And certainly it won't be terribly elaborate, but I'll do my best at it. So is God knowable? Is God the kind of God who can be known? If so, how do we know God and by what means? As I've mentioned, and as we've already mentioned a couple of times on this series so far, the problem of truth, the problem of this question, the problem of the context of truth into which this question sits is a serious problem today for a couple of different reasons, briefly. One is that from inside the Christian's perspective or within the Christian tradition, The biblical texts themselves have come under great scrutiny in the last 150 years, and there's a great deal of skepticism about the authenticity and accuracy and historicity of the texts themselves. There are most scholarship that is done today takes the perspective that the texts are, of course, flawed constructions, corrupted collections done by redactors who, after the events, have constructed the stories of Jesus and the accounts that are presented in the New Testament in particular, and the same would be true of the Old Testament. So the Bible itself is seriously questioned. Secondly, the problem of truth today has been highlighted in perhaps a way that is historically unique. That is, postmodern theory has basically completely undercut or subverted the notion of truth with a capital T, that you can know truth in some reasonably reliable or accurate or certain kind of way. Postmodern theory is, you know, just in general, the child has been given birth by, first of all, the basic theories of Immanuel Kant, who suggested that in his philosophy that we really can't ever know something out there except that it is colored by our own knowing process. That is, our ability to know something always shapes and has an effect, or colors or biases this whatever it is that we're trying to know out here. So there's this great sort of concrete wall, as it were, between what we perceive and what's actually out there. And this has bred in the modern, in our contemporary times, a taken for granted assumption that pervades philosophical thought today, that of skepticism regarding whether you can know anything reliably, truly, or or certainly. Secondly, along with Kant's foundation of kind of a rudimentary skepticism about knowing something in and of itself accurately in any kind of certain way, theories of culture in the last 100 years have emerged that have done a lot of work on how culture works, how culture gets constructed. Anthropology and related social sciences have examined how cultures, how the cultures of mankind, create this thing called culture. And culture is the sum of the artifacts and ideas and beliefs that circulate and percolate around us all in our everyday world, much of which is sort of taken for granted or hidden from us in a conscious way. And so we don't really ever think about culture affecting us or culture being having a blinding effect on us. But culture theory has been also included in the problems of postmodern theory. And then out of culture theory have come the subjects, the problems of language, linguistic theory. And out of what has been known as structuralism and then post-structuralism, which is post-structuralism is sort of another term for postmodern theory, has arisen basically the idea that all of culture is essentially constructed from language. In other words, our reception of the things and the ideas and beliefs around us, our response to the world around us, is translated into language, words, text. And these words are signs or intermediaries. There's a tree, and then there's the word for a tree, and then there's my reception and my use and intent of the word tree. So there's sort of this very elaborate theory called post-structuralism, which basically says that reality, real reality, we have never known. It's always been a myth that we would know anything with certainty, and that, in fact, all we've ever known is our words. All we've ever known is our language. So between Kant's foundation of skepticism, which has become pretty much a boilerplate, taken-for-granted attitude, and then culture theory, and then linguistic theory on top of that, we end up today with an attitude in Western civilization and Western philosophical thought, and it's seeped down pretty much to street-level MTV culture that is kind of a taken-for-granted. I mean, how could you be so arrogant? How could one be so arrogant as to assume that you actually know something with certainty? You can have your opinions. You can have your cultural assumptions. You can have your language. You can have your very finite perspectives. But for you to assume that you actually know something with certainty out there, that's going a bit far. So that's the context of the problem. What I want to do for the next bit here is talk about John Hick's argument in that context. Now, John Hick has put together a theory that he calls, or a philosophical system of religion, a way to look at how religion functions, how religion works, and how religion relates to God. He calls this theory religious pluralism. Religious pluralism. So his theory of religious pluralism is about how we can relate to God or know God. His model is, in his own words, in a sense, a new model, and in a certain sense, a very old model. He says it this way: it is new and old. It's a new and old global vision that in new in the sense that it is only now coming into prominence among us in the West, old in that it has long been there in the mystical strands of all the great religions. So there's a sense in which, as I looked at his book, a couple of books, it reminded me a great deal that in certain way he is an old classical modernist, a modern liberal, hearkening back to the early days when Christian liberalism coming out of Germany in the 19th century was given birth, kind of a classic old-time liberalism that all religions point in one direction, essentially, and kind of a new... The reason his work is becoming so accepted or having such a great influence today is because of the new sense, the postmodern sense of a new kind of spirituality, or a postmodern notion of spirituality, which is very pervasive today, that it's very hip to be spiritual. And whereas 20 years ago, 25 years ago, if you talked about yourself as being a spiritual person, you might have gotten a skeptical look, like, are you wacky? Today, to be spiritual is very, very accepted. Hey, you got your spirituality, I have my spirituality. Hey. It works. So, I want to look at John Hick's model because it has this strong appeal today regarding the new spirituality that floats around us, all around us. And then also because Hick, in the sense that he's kind of an old-time liberal, modernist, not a postmodernist in a most essential way, sees his theory of religion as being very scientific and very rational, very reasonable. So I think it has kind of the appeal on both sides. So here's the basic. What I'm going to do is list 10 basic essential elements of his theory, and they are essential. I could elaborate. I couldn't at this point, but they can be elaborated much more densely than I'm going to. But I think this captures the sense of it. Okay, here's the basic structure. One. God is there, but we have seriously misunderstood who, or rather what, God is, and how we ultimately relate to God. God is the ultimately real, ultimate reality or ultimately real or the real. The real cannot be defined in terms of our normal language and conceptual vocabulary. God is the one, the source, the transcendent, the Godhead, beyond all range of human concepts. In other words, Hick would say that even the words that I'm using to talk about God right now are inaccurate in a very serious and inadequate in a very serious way, because they really don't capture in any real sense the essence of God's true nature. It is the one in itself which remains above and beyond speech, mind, or being itself. Now I'm going to elaborate these notions. Those are his words. Okay, so we've seriously misunderstood or inadequately understood the notion of God to begin with. Secondly, we must clear away all cultural and religious myths about this God or about God and how we relate to God. Our knowledge of God can only enter our consciousness through the range of forms made possible by our own conceptual systems. I'll restate that in normal language. Our knowledge of God can only get to us, we only understand God through our own cultures, languages, habits, and ideas and concepts. We can't understand God or receive God in and of him, her, or itself, because that is just, God is ineffable. It's unspeakable. It's outside of our speech. All we can have is what our own culture that we've grown up with, our own religious framework, maybe if there's a few scattered religions in our understanding somewhere in our life, that we pull together our concept of who God is. But we've got to realize that those are all myths, and they're all cultural realities, cultural products. Thirdly, our conceptual systems, or our religions, are finite and culturally and historically limited. I'm kind of repeating myself here a bit. We cannot know God, the transcendent one, in him, her, or itself. The transcendent is by definition unknowable to us. Now this relates back to this notion of Kant's idea. The Kant's idea is you can't know anything in itself with direct apprehension, direct understanding, direct knowledge of that thing, actual experience of that thing. It always gets filtered through your mind. It's made even more critical. Even it's exacerbated if you think of it this way. Thinking about God and how sort of sketchy the idea of God can be, that makes it even worse. Because God is not knowable in the same way that a tree or a rock or my neighbor is. God is completely outside the categories of knowability. So we have a real problem here. In our quote from him, all the various religions are, listen carefully to these words, all the religions are, quote, enabling contexts. Enabling contexts of the transformation or for the transformation of human existence. In other words, religions are a part of each of our culture. Our culture is a construction of mankind. Nevertheless, our religions enable us to somehow gather some understanding or notion of the existence of the transcendent one. So they are enabling contexts that provide a means by which a transformation in us from sinful and or deluded self-centeredness can occur, a transformation to a new orientation which is conscious of the divine, and provides a new point of centering on the existence of the transcendent or the ultimate, and thus freeing us from what the various religions call the true selfless self, the Atman in Hinduism, the universal Buddha nature, the universal Buddha nature in the image or the image of God in all of us. In other words, he's sort of trying to pull here from various traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity, the image of God. He uses this language to talk about the notion of how they all sort of use language to talk about something that language can't really communicate. Nevertheless, he will go on to say, we begin to get the picture that something beyond us is there. Okay, fourth, all of our ideas about God are culturally filtered and inaccurate. I've been saying that. Every culture and historical period has responded to a need for transcendent explanations in its own ways, in its own period, in its own circumstance. All religious concepts or dogmas about God are, and this is, these are his words, forms which human awareness of the real has been given by human consciousness. In other words, our consciousness, we become aware of the real through the dogmas and theologies of our various religious traditions and cultures and historical periods. Each culture responds to its specific conditions historically and in a specific situation. For example, picture with me, in primitive prehistoric culture, where we have in the caves of Lascaux in France, we have these wall paintings and drawings of horses and animals and beasts and arrows sort of thrown at the images, and we gather the picture that these drawings or paintings were cultic, quote, religious practices that were believed to have some influence on the fates or the powers or the gods or the forces which control all of reality, and therefore when we perform or celebrate or conduct certain kinds of religious practices or cultic practices, we enter into a sort of relationship with these forces that in which they can help us or enable us to survive. We need food. We need the right weather. We need water. We need sustenance. We need to. This is the way we survive. So we call on the forces, the fates, the gods, to do that. Very sort of basic, quote, primitive kind of approach to the transcendent or the real. In ancient Hinduism, you have a lot of different, in fact, hundreds of approaches to the notion of what God is, and historically, over periods of hundreds of years, basically conceiving of God as Brahman, that God is essentially all, and that each of us, the particulars of a specific physical material manifestation, are elements of an illusion that is an extension from the Brahman or from the all, that we're temporary illusions, temporary extensions that ultimately get absorbed back into the all. And then, of course, in modern day times, in other words, that's another cultural manifestation of the impact of the transcendent one, the real, on culture at a particular time and way in history. In modern liberal Christianity, we have the application of theories of science, empirical science, that are brought to bear in a very radical, empirical kind of way to the texts of Christianity, for example, and the result is a great skepticism, basically a view that all these are cultural myths, essentially primitive myths, and that we have to put on our scientific rational lenses and to look at them and to glean from the myths truths that help us live. So, you know, I mean, basically Hick is saying that each period in history and each time and each culture is creating its own language and forms as best it can under the conditions that are prescribed for that time and culture, and trying to extrude some notion or idea of God. So each religion or worldview, how does this happen? How do they construct this? What he suggests is that each religion or cultural religious practice or myth or whatever reads from its surrounding culture and its historical conditions and the events and specific situations that it finds itself, reads what he calls signals or signs of transcendence. The signs of transcendence are, this is the transcendent one, and this is the cosmos, or nature or reality, is everyday reality that we know. And you have a whole set of circumstances down here. You have man, human beings, and trees, and nature, and mountains, and clouds, and sky, and machines, and all this stuff going on in our world and our circumstances. That was quickly done, wasn't it? But embedded in the experience of the world are what he calls, and he's referring here to, he's borrowing from Peter Berger, a sociologist of religion, what he calls signs or signals of transcendence. In other words, embedded in the experience of ordinary everyday reality, the real or the transcendent gives clues to its existence. Clues that there's this ultimate reality that stands above our reality. What are these signals or signs of transcendence? Well, they come in lots of different ways and forms. One is they come through the normal various religious traditions. So within Hinduism and the, you know, vast variety of Hindu practices and beliefs, Buddhism and all the various forms of Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you name it, whatever the religious framework, within those religious traditions and forms, there are certain elements, certain truths, if you say, certain experiences that point to the existence of the spiritual or the transcendent one, or the real, the ultimately real, the transcendent beyond the physical, material, natural world that we live in. He doesn't go specifically into what they are. He often kind of just sort of ends up talking about them all leading to notions of ultimate acceptance and love, the experience of the ineffable, and in some mystical way in our lives. But he simply tries to take the dogmas of each religion and turn them into truths that somehow contain something of, a grain of truth about the transcendent one, and therefore a signal pointing in that direction. The signs or signals of transcendence occur in nature or in creation. That is, when we experience in nature moments of awesome beauty and awe, those moments when we stand at the precipice of some mountain or cliff or some vista, or even sitting under a tree and picking up a leaf and looking at the beauty and the intricacy of some small biological piece of nature. And somehow those moments click and we're just caught in that moment of the design and beauty of it cannot but speak of a designer or of some ultimate cause of this beauty and intricacy. So it's that kind of thing that he's talking about as sort of a clue or a sign of transcendence. He also talks about, I think he would also include the ordinary relations of man in society. That is, just our relationships, just our understandings of each other. When we interact with each other, it's not very long that we bump into each other and find out that we are confronted with moral issues, ethical issues. How are we going to treat each other? How are we going to relate to each other? And thus emerges issues of love, forgiveness, mercy, justice. These ethical issues emerge in society, and also they point to the existence of a transcending one. Okay. The different religious traditions are simply diverse, and I'm being a little bit repetitive here, but just to get the point. The different religious traditions are simply diverse contexts, different ways, in terms of which the universal presence of the ultimately real is differently experienced or appropriated. So I'm going to read a quote here. Accordingly, that the different religions give such different accounts of the ultimate does not mean that if one of them is correct, the others must be incorrect. So far as the differences between them are concerned, they may all be authentic responses to the transcendent. All the different religions are authentic responses to the transcendent, regardless of the differences. And their different theologies may be valid descriptions of the different ways in which that ultimate reality is humanly conceived, and therefore experienced, and therefore responded to in life from within the different cultural ways of being human. The transcendent is experienced by some as an all-powerful cosmic person, and by others as an infinite non-personal reality. As a result, each perceives something different from what is perceived by others. People formed by the different religious traditions become aware of the transcendent in significantly different ways. Next, so all religions or beliefs about the transcendent point in the right direction, and the key here is they point. They are metaphors and symbols. They provide us with clues that all point in one direction. The various God figures and the various non-personal focuses of various religious mediations are, according to our big picture, John Hick's big picture, different transformations of the impact upon us of the ultimately real. But that reality in itself is beyond the range of conscious human experience. It does not fit into the systems of concepts in terms of which we are able to think. It is what it is, but what it is cannot be described in human categories. We can only describe its impact on us, as this is filtered by our limited receptivity and translated in terms of our conceptual systems into the personal or the non-personal objects of religious experience. So let me try to summarize here. What is Hick's basic summary here? What is he saying? One, God is really, our notions of God are really the ultimately real or the transcendent. The ultimately real or transcendent cannot be known or expressed in human terms. The permanent, immortal, here's another 50-cent word, supramundane state which cannot be expressed in mundane terms. In other words, the transcendence, the transcendent cannot be translated into our reality, the immanent, the ordinary physical material reality, created reality. Now he inserts something he calls the critical realist principle. I have to say something about it at this point. There are realities around us every day that we are never aware of as they are in themselves, but always as they appear to us with our particular cognitive machinery and conceptual resources. In other words, he's saying, you know, if you stop and think about it, science and scientific investigation has told us that we can go to the atomic or the subatomic level of reality here in this room, and there would be realities here at that level of which we are unaware. In the same way, analogously, there are realities external to us that we're not aware of because of our finiteness, our cultural setting, our historical setting, whatever it may be, that we don't get, and there are some that we get because of the shape of our thinking ability and our cultural assumptions and beliefs. This is a vital clue to understanding what is happening in the different forms of religious experience. In other words, he's saying the same stuff from the transcendently real is emanating down through every culture and every religion and every point in history. But because of the different cultures, the different shapes and the different characters and the different qualities of the culture, specifics of the cultures, that culture only receives certain things. That one gets these signals. This one here gets these signals. So Christianity gets these signals, Hinduism gets these signals, Buddhism, which extends out of Hinduism, gets these signals, Islam gets these signals, and they're all different. Why are they different? Because they're filtered through the various cultural, historical circumstances of these cultures. So, remember that. The real, he concludes, is good. Loves all of creation and will ultimately bring all of creation into itself. The quote, "It is taken for granted that the structure of the universe enables human existence to move on a vast time scale toward a limitless good fulfillment." I'm going to repeat that. The real is good, loves all creation, and it is taken for granted in his system. And he would argue it's taken for granted. If we really look at what all the religions are saying the same thing. Basically, that the structure of the universe, the way the universe and the cosmos is made down here, the way it's built, enables human existence to move on a vast time scale toward a limitless good fulfillment. So it's basically all good news in his system. Everything gets worked out. Ultimately, all the bad stuff somehow disappears and only good stuff is left. Ultimately, all religions in their essence teach the same fundamental truth, he argues. All religions have developed different pictures of this structure and of the final fulfillment, such as heaven, paradise, union with God, the beatific vision, or absorption into the Brahman in which separate ego existence has been transcended, or nirvana, or the universal realization of the Buddha nature of all things. But it is important to note that the idea of a good outcome of life, of the life process, does not require that any one of these specific conceptions will turn out to be accurate. They don't have to be accurate. Why don't they have to be accurate? Because they can't be accurate. Why can't they be accurate? Because they're filtered through finite cultural reality. So they all get bits and pieces of and clues of the truth, but nobody really gets the truth. How do we get to the truth? We use the critical, what he called a few minutes ago, what I referred to as the critical realist principle. This is where his view of science or rationality or reason comes to play in this whole picture. What he argues is that, sure, there's a lot of information out there in the various religions and cults and myths and beliefs. Well, how in the world do we know? How do we even get to the good? If it's all conditioned and none of it we can count on as being directly accurate, how do we get to the good? Well, he does manage somehow to salvage the notion of reason in our midst, in mankind, in the human being, and that through critical reason we can look at all these differences and analyze them in terms of a criteria that will determine what in each of them is true. So there's a little bit of a contradiction there. On the one hand, you can't know it. On the other hand, he's saying, no, wait a minute. No, you can get there eventually. You can get to it. And getting to it, I'll talk about in just a minute. So how do we know that... let's see here. So then, how does man get it? According to Hick, man gets it when he is open to the transcendent, plain and simple. If one comes through a series of thought processes, or religious experiences, and critical reason to the place where we realize the transcendent is there, then we simply open up to that reality and begin to seek it and to pursue it. So then, he concludes, true, valid religious experience at this level can occur in many different forms. We must, however, be critical in our reception of religious experience, for though there are many paths, not all paths are equally true and valid. There can be an inauthentic response to the real. There can be self-delusion. So we must bring the principle of critical realism to the whole process of our pursuit of what we believe. How do we know the truth from what is not true in each religion? Well, he argues that there are what he calls the marks of genuine transformation that appear in a true knower, someone who gets it, over time. Namely, love, compassion, and tolerance of all. When you see in the life of a human being the virtues of love, mercy, forgiveness, tolerance over a long period of time, we see the marks of authenticity, the crux of the whole point. The crux of the whole point for all religions. And he cites in his book the examples of, we don't have time to go into it, but St. Julian of Norwich, the woman who had mystical visions, and then he also cites Gandhi and gives a couple of other examples. Now, let me begin my critique here. First of all, here's some problems that Hick has to, that I think they're real problems in his system from my perspective. One is, the only way he can make his theory of religions, pluralistic religions, work is to force the distinctives of Christianity in particular, but all religious distinctives, force them into his sort of generic model. The serious differences between the tendency of Eastern religions to be monistic, that is, all is one, and that the distinctives of our reality, the particulars of our reality, are simply a temporary illusion or expression of the all, of the flux of the all that will simply keep cycling. The distinction between that and the, quote, what he calls the Western, which actually Middle Eastern, creator-creature distinction where there is a difference between the Creator and the creation. The Creator transcends the creation. The creation comes from the Creator. But they're not all one. There's a distinction. He completely blows that apart. The only way that he can do that is, in his theory, is to reduce Christianity in particular, because he does kind of take Christianity on in particular. It's kind of between the lines, but it's there. Is to look at the mystical strands of Christianity, all the mystical traditions that come in to Christian history, into the church in after the New Testament times, with Neoplatonic thought, as especially it becomes manifest in the Pseudo-Dionysius, the writings of the Pseudo-Dionysius, in which an idea of the Platonic idea of reality being this other reality and then having kind of a chain of being that extends out of this ultimately real reality, God, the ideal, the forms, the universals, a chain of being from that emanating down into, from spiritual reality, the ineffable to the spiritual to the material, this chain of being, so that at the bottom of the chain of being is material stuff of the cosmos. At the top of the chain of being, and even beyond being, is the ineffable one, or God in himself. And in Pseudo-Dionysius, you don't really talk about God in personal terms at all. That even to attribute personhood to God is, you can't do that, because we don't know. So basically, he has to go, when he looks at, just for example, the issues of Christianity, he has to reduce Christianity to the mystical traditions and basically exclude the distinctives that arise within biblical Christianity in particular, and the traditions that are grounded in the specificity or the specifics of biblical Christianity. But he does that with all the religions. I mean, specific dogmas within particular religions have to be basically kind of smushed around and reshaped or forgotten or put aside somehow. So the distinctives between monotheism and pantheism are basically the distinctions between monotheism or pantheism and theism or biblical theism, Judeo-Christian or Islamic theism, those things are put aside. Those differences are kind of blown over. And he goes specifically to the mystical side of things. The mystical side of things, because in the mystical approaches to Christianity and Judaism and Islam, you find a very strong similar structure to the notions of God or the Brahman or the All in Eastern thought. They come very, very close together, if not becoming identical. Secondly, he basically ignores the specific teachings of Christ in the New Testament and turns, like I said, to the mystical side of things. So he ignores basically he says anything that is distinctive in a religion, any religion, that the claim of which has a kind of exclusivity, that is, this is true and that's not true, any kind of exclusive claims like that, he says, have to be pushed aside. So any of the distinctives of the biblically based religions have to be ignored, for example. So his conclusion is, can we know God? Yes. We can know God in a certain way. And the word that sticks out to me, and I don't remember where it was in the text, I didn't write it down, but he basically suggests that the way that we know God with this kind of setup, since we really can't know God in him, her, or itself, we somehow, through the culturally filtered Signals of Transcendence, gather the notion that God is this, the transcendently real, the ground of all being, that we all, in some sense, owe our existence to this other reality, and that that other reality is good, ultimately good, that we basically get that by bits and clues, and ultimately we don't have certainty. So there's a sense in which he says, yes, we can, and no, we can't. Okay. Can we know God? From my perspective, from the perspective that we would take around here, is yes. Why? We've already touched on some of these things. We have argued, as David did last week, that truth is knowable. That basically we operate our everyday lives on that fact. Truth is knowable, and that the criterion of truth with absolute certainty that we find used in a laboratory of science is really beside the point. We don't really operate in 99% of the existence of our lives. We don't use that kind of evidence or that kind of certainty upon which to live our lives. We know in a commonsensical kind of way. And when we're confronted with elements of reality that are mistaken or that are wrong, we have the apparatus to make that judgment and to make adjustments. So the skepticism about knowing at all is really an inheritance of the modern and the postmodern age in particular. And it's one that, as David talked about last week, is in many ways, in its core, invalid. Truth is knowable. And I would argue that we, all of us, at some intuitive, profound intuitive level, want to know the truth, expect to know the truth, and expect to live our lives based on the knowledge of what we believe is true. Now, it may not be true, but we have the apparatus to make the adjustment when we find out something isn't true. God has given us, first of all, we can know God because truth is knowable. Secondly, I think we can know God because God has given us two things. One, he has given us signals of transcendence. I don't think that Hick is wrong about this. I think that God has built into creation these, what he calls, signals of transcendence. One of them is alluded to in Ecclesiastes, where the preacher or the writer of Ecclesiastes says, "He, God, has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, so that man will not find out the work." Basically, I want to stop with that. The basic notion is, biblical notion is, that God has created the creature, us, in such a way that we yearn for what is ultimately true. We even yearn for knowledge of what is transcendently and ultimately true. We have at some serious and profound level, we have to work at ignoring that. And we do that, but we have to work at it. The second thing, so there are signals of transcendence in creation, I think, are true and accurate and are there, and they do lead us to, they do give us clues about the existence of God. Secondly, this God that he's speaking of, the creator, the biblical creator God, is or has extended knowledge of himself into this created reality. In other words, it's not us simply trying to work through what is an ineffable, unknowable barrier to our knowledge, a concrete sort of barrier to our knowledge of God, but God has stepped into history. God has acted toward us in a very specific way. That's basically what the scriptures, the Bible, are claiming, the Bible's claiming. That we have very specific information in the biblical revelation culminating in the specific life, teachings, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. So that the Bible would argue with us, and certainly the New Testament authors would argue with us, look at these claims that we're making, specific, concrete, historical claims that we say are true about Jesus and about what happened, and these are the marks or the evidences, the signs of the God of the Bible and the truth of what the God, what we're claiming the truth of the God of the Bible has said to us in revealed Scripture, in the Bible. There's a certain sense in which, from the biblical perspective, we're actually held accountable for that knowledge. I'll get there in just a moment. So what does the Bible mean by knowing God? How does the Bible frame this whole notion of knowing God? I'll try to wrap this up in about like 3 or 4 minutes. One, our intellectual and cognitive and reasoned rational capacities are given information about God, creation, man, and the gospel of Christ, and that this information satisfies our normal need for believing something that is reasonable and knowable, that it's concrete, that its character is commonsensical. We can have some confidence about that because the Bible talks about in John 1, I can't remember if Dave, I think Jack alluded to this in his talk. In John 1, we have the statements about that classic passage about God in the beginning. And the description of God in the beginning was the Logos. Briefly put, the picture that the Bible presents is that God, the transcendent one, the God of all reality, the God of the Bible, is the source of the creation of all reality, that God is the source of ultimately reasonably knowable knowledge, because he is reasonable. That God is reasonable and rational, and that the creation he has created is reasonable and rational. And that is, the creation itself is able to receive information from God in a similar pattern. Whereas Hick is skeptical about that. He basically says the transcendent one is unknowable. We can't even talk about it with normal language. The Bible presents God as being transcendent above the creation, but having revealed himself. And that the nature of the revelation corresponds to what is knowable around us. So there's this coherence, this correspondence between what God has revealed to us, the nature and structure of creation, and our knowing processes. They're all, in a sense, structured by this notion of the Logos. That in the beginning was the Logos. We have reality and culture around us that are into which are embedded signals of transcendence, which I've already talked about. In Romans chapter 1, and this is what I alluded to just a moment ago, there's a sense in which the evidence, the biblical claim is that the signals of transcendence embedded in reality, in creation, in our experience, in our very beings, is so clear that we have to be real rebels to ignore it. In Romans 1, I'll just read that passage real quickly. 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. For that which is known about God is evident within them or among them. It's around us. It's with us. For God made it evident to us by putting it around us and in us. It's close to us. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. That is, we, human beings, we are without excuse. For even though they knew God in this sense, the knowledge was close at hand, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to become wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, of birds, of four-footed animals, and crawling creatures. So the basic picture is that God has given us adequate information around us in the signals of transcendence. He's built our very knowing processes to fit with creation and with the information, specific information he's given us in the life, in the biblical characters, in the biblical history, and ultimately in Christ. And then next, the information that we have in the scriptures about the historical specificity of Christ himself and the truth claims that are there, plus the biblical, the rest of the biblical worldview that is embedded there for us, is in language. Language and communication works. It's finite. We can make a lot of mistakes. It's fallible, but it works at its core. The language of the New Testament, the language of the Old Testament, the language we have in the specific information we have about God is the kind of information that we can bring our reasonable reasoning apparatus to and determine its authenticity and determine its truthfulness in correspondence with all of our experience of life and our experience of ourselves. So language, whereas in Hick's theory, language is at best able to give us clues or metaphors or symbols or some pointers. Language in the biblical worldview, in the biblical frame of reference, is adequate and can be sufficiently clear such that we can act with accountability toward it. In fact, that's exactly what this Romans 1 passage goes on to say, that in fact there's enough information there that God will actually hold us accountable for that information. So the signals of transcendence, as we're calling it here, are powerful. And then lastly, the way our worldviews work, the way we construct a picture of ourselves and the world around us that we often around here called a worldview. And that process is such that we, it's like here's a picture of reality that we have, and here we are, an individual trying to make sense of the world, and we're taking in the world around us, and we're putting into our worldview various observations and conclusions and judgments that David talked about last week. And we construct this picture of the world. Well written. We construct this picture of the world. But the picture of the world isn't fixed. It's a world that's constantly under construction. The reason and rationality that God granted his creatures is such that we can take in the world and take in information, construct a worldview out of it, and as we find elements of the worldview that are wrong, we take them out and we replace them with new information or new judgments. So that the worldview, the whole worldview construction process that we use, within which at any given time we say, these things I think are true, is a process of an ongoing search for what is true. It's not a closed process, it's an open process. And the fact that it's an open process means that we can have confidence if we are really interested in what is true and pursuing what is true, we can have some confidence that we can actually make progress on that and actually get there. So, and then finally, just 2 points. We have what I just mentioned as information in the world, in us, in creation, that is intellectually, cognitively based and satisfying. That is, the call to know God is grounded in everyday apparatus that we own, that we use every day, and that corresponds, and that we can be confident, have a measure of serious confidence in, as we use it to figure out the world and ourselves and who God is. More profoundly, in the biblical worldview, God gives us, when it comes to truth, if we have hearts, if we have minds, if we have if we have wills to want to know what is true, we have desires to want to know what is true, the Bible tells us that God gives us eyes to see and ears to hear, such that when we hear the distinctives of the gospel, of Christianity, and the claims of Jesus himself, not only do we have the rational apparatus, but we also understand from the biblical perspective that that rational apparatus is colored by our own rebellious nature, by the fact that we have a proneness within us to want to escape accountability to God, that we want to run from that, that we want to hide from that, because when the light of goodness, of true goodness, shines on us personally, we find ourselves morally culpable. And we're not particularly comfortable with that. It takes a real change of heart for us to even want to know this kind of truth. The Bible makes it clear that when that God is able to give us, and does indeed give us, eyes to see and ears to hear, a change of moral disposition, a change of the posture of the heart, such that we do and want to know what is truth, in combination with our reasoned, commonsensical approach to what is true about God and us and the world. What does it mean to know God biblically? I haven't even really addressed that. I think it's going to come up in the next series of talks. To know God biblically speaking means believing with the mind and the heart, believing existentially, personally, embracing the story of reality that the God of the Bible is presented to us, such that our whole existence, our whole lives, and all the choices in my life, our lives, are marked and made with these truths in mind. To know God is to believe the story that the Bible presents about God, about reality, and about man and his condition, the condition of being human. What's true about us at the core? And then, having seen that, to embrace it in such a way that choices, decisions, and events in our lives, we desire to push in a direction that conforms with that picture of reality that we have of God. Let's take a few questions. We've gone a little longer than we wanted.
Does he lay out his own theory of knowing the mundane reality?
He basically accepts the scientific notions of knowing reality. In other words, that's where he's a real modernist. He basically accepts modern science and reason and rationality.
But he doesn't allow those rules to be applied to the real.
Exactly. Only in this at this level of reality can we use those critical apparatus, those tools of critical thinking, to determine between all the myths and truths that we find. We can look at that and say, okay, these I accept, and how do we accept them, on what basis? Because they all end up saying that everything's going to work out great. And really, it's about as general as that.
What's the difference between his approach and some freshman philosophy student who thinks he's got it all wired? I mean, it sounds very true.
It's philosophically very... it's full of erudite language and philosophically informed and all that kind of stuff, but it's basically...
Can you quickly summarize again what his view of language is? Is it just, like, is it the worst thing possible to communicate with, or what?
No, I think he just says that when it comes to God, language doesn't really work.
So did he just tell us not to read his book?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the internal inconsistencies. I didn't really take time to talk about a couple of those, but that's a really, really important one. On what basis would we decide that his theory is more important or more valid than something that, like, the, quote, exclusive claims of biblical Christianity? that he has no criterion that he gives us except his notions that, well, he does talk about religions that are true are cosmically optimistic.
We're talking Carl Sagan cosmically, or
cosmically, metaphysically optimistic, spiritually optimistic. That is the things in each religion that are true somehow present a pleasant picture that it's all going to work out. And all this idea of people going to hell and people not making it and all that kind of stuff, that's not cosmically optimistic. And so, sorry. Yes.
Even if you don't accept religious pluralism, it seems to me the filter of culture has to be accounted for.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I would say that Martin Luther probably read the scriptures with a different filter than you do.
Absolutely.
So how do you account for that filter?
I think that that's a really good point. I think that one of the great missing studies in contemporary biblical Christian communities is exactly that we don't bring cultural lenses to examine the nature of our own beliefs. We don't turn the lenses on ourselves. We don't have a very good understanding of how culture works. And when we really need to bring those understandings and those perspectives even to our study of the Bible. I mean, we cannot get to what's true in the Bible such that we can then believe it or not believe it, until we factor in serious cultural issues and historical distances between us and the original authors and their audiences. So culture is a huge factor.
Why did you pick John Hicks?
I didn't.
He set up for handlers. Is it something that is relevant to today? Are people kind of chiming in along with John Hicks?
Well, I know that my handler picked John Hicks because he had an experience that he thought it would be good for us to at least raise the notion and give some familiarity with it, which is basically all I've done tonight is kind of giving you rough familiarity with it. But I think that for the reasons that I stated to begin with, today in the context of the flowering of postmodern New Age spiritualities that are just by the millions out there. The whole notion of us being spiritual creatures has a new plausibility and new power. And what Hick does is he brings a theory that has an appeal on the surface. It has an appeal to a kind of spirituality that has a kind of, you know, a certain kind of modern reasonableness to it. I mean, it can be, you know, sort of sound logical. If you ignore certain facts, it sounds really interesting and really attractive in the sense that it really doesn't take, it really kind of just pushes evil to the side and really doesn't deal with it and say, well, it's all going to work out. So it's attractive in that sense, and it doesn't take into account those kinds of things, I don't think, very seriously, right?
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned how to discuss his work, you needed to take, first of all, we needed to take our biblical matrix and put it here on for a minute, just to realize what kind of a worldview is coming from. And then I realized if we're going to discuss anything if you and him were in a room and discussing things over a table, you wouldn't be able to. At the end, you brought in biblical Christianity. You still would be able to do that. If you're going to discuss in the arena of ideas his viewpoint and how it would differ from yours, he has rejected anything as being primitive and culturally influenced. If you use biblical Christianity,
yes.
Okay. So, I guess it. And it's a lot has to do with what you just said. Romans 1 definitely paints a pretty good picture of some of the
tools a person can use just of what we have in reality. But there's really no way to discuss anything of as far as what we personally have been shown or convicted from history, be it texts, be it miracles, or anything with a person that holds to something that where history and reality are a primitive construct in which it's actually a hindrance to knowing his world.
I mean, that would be very hard to have a conversation with someone who really didn't, who really accepted it. I think theoretically what you would want to do is find some common ground, some agreements about like the signals of transcendence, and then try to find the areas where there's some serious, either he's ignoring certain what you think are very real signals of transcendence that
he's discussed a miracle.
He's ignoring, or even the nature of evil and how it ultimately gets resolved, or those kinds of things. You just have to pick your way through that.
It sounds like he adopts pretty much a Hegelian synthesis rather than an antithesis in his thought. Otherwise, kind of a melding. There are no antithesis in religion, is said at a fundamental level.
Yeah, he's really inconsistent with that. I mean, at this level down here in the real world, he is a rational. He's a rationalist. I mean, he counts on antithetical thought. But when it comes to the transcendent, those categories fly out the window. And so he wants his cake and he wants to eat it too. So that's how his system, that's what he tries to do with his system is use antithetical thought at this level right here, but then when it comes to really knowing something with that thought, then he really sort of backs off and says, well, the best we can do is reduce the specifics to myths and symbols and clues rather than specific dogmas that actually contradict each other.
He uses kind of a limiting cap or factor.
Yeah. Yeah, he's inconsistent with that.
What's the Hegelian antithesis?
Hegelian? What did you say? Well, I don't know. Basically, it's something like this. Hegel's thought was that you have A, and you have not A. You have antithesis, you have thesis and antithesis.
Okay.
And what basically, although this is a vast oversimplification of my understanding of what Hegel suggested, was that whereas these are normally thought of as being opposites, mm-hmm. if this is true, then this is its opposite. It's not true. This is the opposite of it.
Right.
What he suggests is that in a quote dialectic, that is, there's a tension set up between these two. And that tension produces a synthesis, which sets up another thesis and another opposite, not A. And there sets up another tension, and then another synthesis is created, which is another A and an opposite, not A. In Hegelian's thought, this dialectical truth is that truth is not static, it's always in motion. And you can't, at any one time, you could stop and recognize thesis, antithesis, but you always understand that there's the tension and force between the two, the dialectic between the two, is always going to force a third option or another, extrude another option from it, or pressure out another option. That forms another thesis. And an opposite of it, and then the process keeps going. So it's a sort of it's a notion of unfolding truth, truth in motion.
Okay.
One more.
Okay. Going back to the cultural filter idea, just applying it to the Protestant world where there's hundreds of different groups, each group I would suggest is created with a filter. How then do you determine the truth within the Protestant world? I mean, you have such variations from the Mennonites to the Pentecostals.
Yeah.
Where and what tool do you use to determine the truth?
Well, I'll do a commercial here. There are several folks here on the teaching staff and the faculty of Gutenberg that have actually addressed that with some depth. So there is some writing. There's a book coming out on hermeneutics, the issues of biblical interpretation in general, and so that would be available. Just quickly, from the seat of my pants, our position around here would be that normal human language, whether it be in the local everyday newspaper or in an ancient primitive text, that the way language works is that we have to consider the author's, what we can determine to be the author's intention to his audience. So we are very much of the school of authorial intent. And so our target is to find the author's intent in the cultural context. And we have what, around here, what would be considered a, what? Unpopular kind of exclusivist kind of, you know, a politically incorrect view that actually we can make serious progress toward figuring out what the original author meant if we apply rigorously, ruthlessly, honestly, the objective of figuring out what did the author mean, and that language works in such a way that we can actually figure that out. It's a process, but it can be figured out. There are people, if you really are interested, like I said, there's much more adequate information than what I just said, but that's it. Thank you all for coming.